This Janet Mefford Today podcast is sponsored by Heart for Lebanon, the Christian ministry working among 2 million Syrian refugee families who've been displaced. For just $29 a month, you can help Heart for Lebanon reach out in Jesus' name to a family of six, providing them with food, Christian education, survival essentials, and the gospel. Please call now, 888-247-5499. That's 888-247-5499 or janetmefford.com.
This is Janet Mefford Today.
Our confidence is in Christ alone.
Are we going to stand with God, come what may?
If the Word of God says it, I believe it.
And that's the way it is.
And now, here is Janet Mefford.
Thank you so much for joining us again. In the last several decades, and especially in the last several years, our culture has really gone through a major moral and spiritual decline. And if you add to that the widening gap between Americans on worldview and religious persuasion, you have all the markings of a true impending crisis that might actually already be here. How did our collective cultural values change, and what can Christians possibly do about it? Joining me today, journalist and commentator Billy Hallowell, who is out with a new book about it. It is called Fault Line: How a Seismic Shift in Culture is Threatening Free Speech and Shaping the Next Generation. Great to have you here again, Billy. How are you?
I'm doing well. Thanks for having me.
It's great to have you back. Now, talk about this crisis we're in. I guess some people might think we're already there. Some say we're not quite there. What do you think of where we are as a culture right now in terms of our morality and our spirituality?
You know, I think we're in a really, really dangerous place, and it is hard to tell. I feel like we're kind of in the middle of it. We're inching toward it. I think the millennial generation, which I'm on the upper end of, I'm 33 years old, so I'm kind of edging that generation now. I think that's where the big crisis is, but there's a broader crisis throughout culture that impacts, I think, everybody. But you start to look at the numbers, and for me, the most shocking number has been really just looking at relativism, where the country is on morals and values. Do we believe there is truth, solid truth? You know, as Christians, we believe in a basis of truth. So when you look at statistics, the vast majority of the country is now saying, oh, well, you know, cultures can make up their own truth. Truth is found in the individual. You know, that is very concerning when you start having a culture suddenly say, oh, well, this is all relative. Yeah. And even 51% of millennials, when you ask the more direct question, will say that truth is relative. So that, to me, is sort of the starting point. And you kind of look there and you say, okay, well, what else is going on? And you can go to the Gallup poll, and I break this all down in Fault Line, and you can go to almost any poll and look at the trending data. And what's really crazy to me is you go back to 2002, you look at where the country stood on a variety of issues, and you compare that to 2016, and it is really shocking. Even divorce, for instance, Gallup had asked, you know, back around 2002, you know, is divorce morally acceptable? And you had around 57, 59% of the country saying yes, and now we're over 70% of the country saying yes. People having, you know, women having babies out of wedlock, a huge, I think it's 67% of the public saying that that's morally acceptable now. So that's when you start digging a little bit deeper. And it, I mean, there's even issues. Polygamy went from 7% of the country saying it's morally acceptable to 14%, which was a little bit shocking to me in looking at those numbers. So there's a big change afoot. And I think as Christians, we've sort of felt this more the last couple of years, because a lot of this is sort of coming to a head.
Yeah, it sure is. I was watching a clip not too long ago. You might have caught this as well, but it was an interview, a TV interview that was done with a Planned Parenthood executive. And the executive was asked, well, if there is a little 5.5 week old fetus and there's a heartbeat, what is that thing? Is that a blob of tissue? Is that a person? And the response from the Planned Parenthood executive was, it's up to each individual to decide what that is.
Yes, I
thought that is a recipe for chaos, but that's where we are. If you have gotten onto the train of moral relativism to that extent, what in the world? Where do you go from there? Everybody just individually decides what's right and wrong. Why have laws?
Well, and then they hit a wall, right? Because then you start to say, okay, well, what about ISIS? Do they get to pick what's right for their culture?
Yeah.
You know, because if that's your baseline, well, you know, everyone just has to pick what they think is moral and right. I mean, the other problem is that we've just been so dumbed down that, you know, if we say that, then we're not even willing to think deeper and say, okay, well, I mean, even on gay marriage, there are some people out there who might say, well, I don't really want the government involved in marriage, and so I'll let the legal part of it go, but the moral part I will not compromise on. So you've got people at different levels, but we're even losing that, ability. It's sort of like whatever anybody says for themselves has to be the truth, and it has to be okay. We can't judge it. And the reality is that all of this, I mean, this relativism, I believe, and I make this point in Fall Line, it boils down to where we learn, right? Where we learn. That is how we got here.
Yes.
That's one of the ways we got here. And we learn from the media, we learn from Hollywood, and we learn from universities for most of us, and we could have a broader conversation about public schools, but I focus in the book on universities because that is, I mean, you spend 18 years of your life growing up, especially for millennials, I would make this point, we grew up with technology that other generations didn't have, being inundated with these messages. You hit college, you go into a university, and there, unless you've gone to a Christian school or a very specific type of school, you are again getting this worldview reinforced, a secular worldview that does not embrace the values that most Christians would embrace. So
yes,
that's the 30,000-foot view issue that we have, and it really poses a cultural problem for us.
Well, it sure does, and we've seen with this free speech debate, which you also talk about in the book, more and more what's happening is if you have an alternate worldview, a Christian worldview, a biblical worldview, they want you to shut up. I mean, you're a hater, you're a bigot, you're a homophobe, you're an Islamophobe, they call you a bunch of basket of deplorables, whatever the insult of the day happens to be. It's crushing dissent, which is absolutely anathema to what America has always stood for. But isn't that part and parcel of rejecting the foundation of the Bible upon which, like it or not, our civilization rests?
Absolutely. Well, and I mean, these people will destroy your career. They will go after you. They will do whatever they can do. I mean, you can go and look at Chip and Joanna Gaines and what happened to them with their show Fixer Upper.
Yep.
And there, it was a non-story. Somebody essentially made up, went after them, even though they hadn't denied a gay couple going on their show, went after them relentlessly, created a story out of nothing on BuzzFeed, and then you have this viral story. They will literally try to destroy you. And what's so sad about this to me is that it creates a free speech problem.
Yeah.
And you mentioned college campuses. Everyone's so afraid. They don't want to be offended by another idea that we're banning people, we're not allowing conservative and or Christian speakers, we're trying to stop Christian clubs, which I talk about in the book. We have these all-comers policies that I'm sure you know about, where it basically the college will say, well, you can't require your leaders in a student club to have certain beliefs. And for Christians, obviously, you need your leaders to believe in the Bible, and so most Christian clubs will require that, and they suddenly find themselves unable to be an officially recognized club, and it really doesn't impact a lot of other clubs on campus, mainly Christian clubs. So this is a problem across the board, and it hurts secularists, it hurts atheists, and it also hurts liberals. And I think this is the part that nobody talks about, but they are depriving themselves of having perspective, understanding what people believe. And obviously it's a free speech problem for conservatives and Christians as well. But it's a sad situation. And the one thing that I really wanted to drive home in Fault Line is that we've been complaining about each of these areas for a long time, the media, Hollywood, and universities, but a lot of times we don't have the statistics, we don't have the proof to sort of back up what it is that we're saying, right, which is that
right.
We feel this bias. So I tried to really arm people with a lot of information and stats that sort of show where we are in each of those areas.
Well, that is so good, and I very much appreciate what you had to say about the left being less intellectually rigorous for having stamped out certain points of view, conservative points of view. I mean, you look at what happened in Berkeley not too long ago, and a speaker coming on campus, and they just went nuts. The anarchists show up, and they start setting things on fire. When a culture reaches that point, Billy, what does that really say about us? What does that say about our long-term prospects?
I mean, I think we've lost our way, and that's the issue here. And it doesn't mean that everyone has to be a Christian. I would love as many people as possible to be Christians, but we've lost our way, and we've also lost our values. Even if you aren't a Christian, the value of free speech, expression, this has somehow moved. Our culture has somehow moved into this bizarre world of demonizing and destroying and pushing people out and saying, you're not going to have a presence here. We're going to make sure that because what you believe is just so awful and terrible and horrible, you're not a good person and you can't be present. And what's so insane to me is that this change has happened so fast,
yes,
right?
Right.
You go back 5-6 years and we wouldn't have even imagined that some of the things that are happening now are happening. But really, I think the long-term issue here is, and this is why the book's called Fault Line, we're sort of sitting in the middle of this seismic shift, and this earthquake we feel culturally is either starting or we're in the middle of it or it's about to happen. And if we don't engage, if we don't do something to try to fix this situation, I think we're only looking at a worsening problem. And you can look to the UK and other places in Europe to see what happens to free speech when you start to let it slip away.
So true. We're going to come back. Billy Hallowell with us. Faultline is his book, and we'll return on Janet Mefford Today after this break. Don't go away. Hi, this is Janet Mefford, and I want to tell you about a 10-year-old Syrian girl named Hanifa. Hanifa lost her mother when she was just 18 months old, and now she lives in a refugee camp in Lebanon. She's smart, she's vivacious, and she's seen more suffering than a child her age should ever see, all because she's a victim of what the UN calls the worst humanitarian crisis since World War II. But because Heart for Lebanon is on the ground in her camp, Hanifa recently placed her faith and trust in Jesus for salvation, and now because her father is illiterate, she's reading the Bible to him every evening. The Lord is using Heart for Lebanon in a powerful way. They're bringing food, survival essentials, and Christian education to girls like Hanifa and their families. And these families are coming to know the Lord. But Heart for Lebanon needs your help to keep helping the desperate. Right now, you can help rescue a family of six in Lebanon with food, Christian education, and survival essentials for just 98 cents a day. That's just $29 a month. All you have to do to help is to call now, 888-247-5499. That's 888-247-5499. Or there's a banner to click at janetmefford.com. The war in Syria is not over. And even if the war stopped today, the UN estimates it will take 50 years to rebuild the country. Jesus said the harvest is plentiful, but the workers are few. The Lord has sent the workers of Heart for Lebanon into his harvest field, but they need the help of other Christians to keep on doing what they're doing. We need your help. $29 a month will help rescue a family of six. All you have to do is call now, 888-247-5499. That's 888-247-5499. Or there's a banner to click at janetmefford.com. These families need your immediate help. Please pick up the phone and call. 888-247-5499. 888-247-5499. Thank you, and God bless. We're back on Janet Mefford Today. How did this seismic shift in culture come about, and why is it threatening free speech and shaping the next generation? What is going on? That's what we're talking about with Billy Hallowell. His book is called Faultline. Billy, you made the remark before we went to the break, and I want to pick up on that because you said this change has happened so fast. The attacks on free speech, everything that we're seeing in terms of the acceptable worldview, and you have to stamp out the dissent. I think of a perfect example of that was the idea that two people of the same sex could ever be married was laughable 20 years ago. It was unthinkable, and in fact was never seriously even put forward as a serious idea until about the year 2000. And look how quickly not only has it been legalized, but you have a majority of Americans getting on board and saying, oh, it's fine now. I mean, that just shows the rootlessness, doesn't it, of their morality. It's just rootless. It's not based on anything eternal or solid. It's based on, oh, well, this is what we're doing now.
Well, and look, you can go right to those statistics, and this is one that I have on the top of my head. You know, Gallup asking Americans back in 2002, to your point about 2000 sort of being the turning point, about 40% of the country said they felt that, you know, marrying somebody of the same sex was moral. And so some people would have said, wow, that's kind of high at the time. That's now at 60%, right? So, and some polls would even find it higher. So something clearly changed during that time, and I believe it was Hollywood and the messaging and the way that people on the left sort of marketed that issue. And let's say, I mean, even if you break this down a little bit further, it isn't just that gay marriage was legalized, because people have been having that debate now. It's what has happened since 2015 that has been so shocking, right?
Right.
It hasn't even been 2 years, and we have bakers who have been fined $135,000, and I actually have a section in the book that dives deep into the legal issues that are resulting from this. You have people going after businesses, shutting them down. You had that Memories Pizza that didn't even deny a gay wedding, just said they wouldn't want to serve pizza at a gay wedding, and they were being harassed and attacked. So this is, it is not just the legalization of it, it's the behavior after, and really bizarre to me that we could go from, you know, not even being willing to accept gay marriage to now punishing people for having a traditional view on it that existed for thousands of years.
It's insane. Or that story just recently about the polyamorous group. I don't even know what to call them. I'm not going to call them a family, but the husband and wife, and then they brought in their neighbor, and then she got pregnant, and then the two women ran off together, and now this judge has awarded tri-custody of a 10-year-old boy to three people. It's just, I don't even know where to go with that. But you really do focus on this important point, and I don't want to miss this because this is the main point in your book, where it all boils down to where we learn the media and Hollywood and college campuses. Talk a little bit first about how we learn from the media and how the media has impacted the downshift in our culture and the kind of the slippery slope that we've all seen come forward from all this.
I think with the media, the one challenge is that people assume that every journalist is sort of, at a national level, is sort of out to get Christians and out to get conservatives. And there are definitely examples, I think, of bias where we say, oh gosh, that was so overt or intentional. But I think the vast majority of bias that happens in media, and this actually makes it more dangerous, is basically due to ignorance. That reporters, a lot of them, and I actually recount this in the book, only about 8% of journalists in 2007 told Pew that they go to church weekly, right? Yeah. So you've got about 8% of journalists going to church weekly, and you've got about, you know, 40% of the nation at that time reporting that they go to church weekly. So there's already a gap there. And you can assume with that gap that translates into an inability to understand really what faith, specifically Christianity, means to those journalists. And so you have this deep ignorance. You have a lot of reporters who live in New York City and Atlanta in big cities who probably aren't in touch or around as many conservatives and or Christians. And so you can see how this worldview bias creeps in with journalists. And the final point on that I would make is that, you know, having gone to journalism school, you're taught not to have an opinion. You know, you have to be unbiased, which is great, but the reality is we're all human beings, and so we have opinions. And I think a lot of journalists assume, you know, like they won't go out and vote for a candidate during an election because they think that compromises them, but that just makes them feel better. It doesn't change what's inside of them or what they believe.
Right.
And so I think it creates this false perception of being middle of the road when in reality they might be conservative or liberal and they're not realizing that. So, you know, to that point, that impacts, though, that worldview bias, everything from who they bring on to interview to the organizations whose statistics they cite to the stories they choose to cover and not cover. And I think over the years we have felt, a lot of Christians and conservatives, not well represented by the mainstream media because of that. And very little has been done to fix the problem.
Yeah.
And it makes me laugh sort of because I feel like we've fixed, when we talk about privilege in so many other ways, we try to intervene to fix it, or we have a discussion about it, or there's this big cultural, you know, whatever on to try to equalize things. But when it comes to ideology, we sort of ignore the complaints that people have had for eons about the media. So I would say our big issue there, though, is realizing that a lot of this is pervasive and they may not even realize that it's happening. And so that you have to understand to combat it, I think.
Oh, for sure. Well, and that's my background, too. I worked as a journalist for years. I was an editor. I was a reporter. And I worked in those newsrooms, and the ignorance was unbelievable when it came to Christianity. And the problem is that when you have newsrooms that are populated largely by people who are not Christians, the other problem is that you don't have a lot of Christians going into journalism. And I tell people that a lot, too. I said there aren't a lot of people going. I mean, it's a low paying profession, generally speaking, but there aren't a lot of conservative Christians who say, golly gee, I'd really like to spend my time in a newsroom with those people I can't stand. I mean, it's a calling, but, you know, it's hard, too, from the Christian's perspective to be there.
Absolutely. And that is one of the things, right? The fact that only 8% go to church every week. Okay, well, that's on, obviously there's a bias, that's on them, but it's also on us too, even though it's difficult. You know, what are we going to do to engage? Because it's so easy to dismiss people when they're not there, right? It's easy to you know, make fun of Christians or laugh about what they believe when there's not one sitting next to you. But when there is, you might think twice. And I've experienced this working in media, and I've experienced it here in New York, just being around people who don't agree with me. When they get to know me, it's harder for them to dismiss me. And
exactly.
So a friendship and a relationship is built, even on a professional level, that I think is important to helping equalize some of this.
Yeah, that's right. And when you talk about the sector of Hollywood and the entertainment, the arts and all the rest, that's another profession in which a lot of people say there are hardly any Christians. And the Christians who are there, they don't want to speak up too much because they won't get employed. What about the worldview that Hollywood presents and the impact it has on Americans when in reality there isn't a lot of diversity?
Yeah, and that's so funny. I mean, watch the Oscars, right? We've had so many examples, and I don't care what people believe about Donald Trump, what they think, whether they like him, whether they hate him. The reality is it's sort of insufferable to be lectured by Hollywood.
Yes.
And this has gone on for eons. It happened with George Bush. It continues to happen where there's just such a one-sidedness. And so there's that element, the political element. But one of the things I cover in the book, obviously, is the faith element. What is Hollywood putting out? How is it changing and damaging our culture? And I think we know for a fact there are countless studies, and I recount them in the book, showing that what happens to young people when they watch sexual content, when they watch violent content, and yet when you look at what's going on television, in movies, there has been an influx of that content. So if we know that that affects young people, why are we continuing to put that out? Why is Hollywood not concerned? They could still make their money. I mean, look, they make a ton of money on kids' films. And now, of course, we have the Beauty and the Beast
debate
that's going on.
Yes.
But the reality is there is a huge problem when it comes to content, television in particular. You can't even turn on primetime without being horrified by what you're watching. And it makes it really tough for parents who are trying to raise their kids the right way. And so we just see that pervasiveness. I think Hollywood has intentionally taken on issues, we know this, and has intentionally and successfully changed perceptions by ensuring that other viewpoints are not present, or that when they do present Christians, they do it in a way that is really not very flattering.
Yeah, it's so true. It's so true. I thank the Lord every day for DVDs because we have been able to get old movies and old TV shows. My youngest two girls are right now very obsessed with Little House on the Prairie, which thrills me to no end because there's so much other stuff I don't want them watching. What about the solution, though, Billy? I know this is not something you can neatly tie up in a little bow in a package. What kind of advice do you give to Christians, though, about how to operate in a culture like ours and how to really be salt and light?
I think that's the key is, are you standing by your values and not compromising them? And so we need people to not compromise their values. So if you're going to enter into Hollywood, the media, or universities, which is what I do advocate in the book, and I know that other people don't advocate that. They want Christians to sort of retreat. There's another book out right now that has a very different solution to what I'm proposing.
Yep.
You know, retreat and refine.
Yeah, no. No.
My philosophy is, get involved, be present, but hold on to your values. And look, we can't all be actors and producers and professors. But if that's where you're being called, that's your skill set, go for it. And if you're a parent and you see that in your kid, you see those qualities in your child, encourage it. I think we need to, we keep pulling away. And pulling away, I think we've only exacerbated and metastasized the problem that we have in these arenas. And people's lives, people's salvations matter. We need to reach people, but we need to do it not just through preaching to the choir, not just through, faith films are great. I love them. Don't get me wrong. And I think we need to have them. But we also need movies that tell good stories from directors who are Christians and actors who are Christians, and not just the other way around,
right.
Christian actors and Christian directors. And same with media. We need Christians in media who are working at secular outlets. So that is my 30,000-foot view solution, and in the book, I present examples of people who have done that successfully and who continue to do it successfully.
Well, I think that that's excellent because we were never told by Jesus to, bunker down, get in your bunker, and just wait for me to come back. I mean, we are supposed to occupy till he comes and be salt and light. And a great book. It's called Fault Line. Billy Hallowell joining us. So kind of you, Billy. It was great to talk to you.
It was great to talk to you. Thanks for having me.
Thank you very much. And we'll be back right after this. This Janet Mefford Today podcast is sponsored by Heart for Lebanon, the Christian ministry working among 2 million Syrian refugee families who've been displaced. For just $29 a month, you can help Heart for Lebanon reach out in Jesus' name to a family of six, providing them with food, Christian education, survival essentials, and the gospel. Please call now, 888-247-5499. That's 888-247-5499 or janetmefford.com. Welcome back to Janet Mefford Today. Well, Martin Luther is known throughout the world as the monk whose 95 theses nailed to a church door in Wittenberg, Germany, kicked off the Protestant Reformation. Now, we know a lot about Luther's journey from medieval Roman Catholicism to his embracing of the gospel of Jesus Christ. But 500 years after the Reformation, relatively very little is known or discussed about Luther's marriage. He once said he would never get married, only to go on to marry a nun named Katharina von Bora and ending up having a family of his own. So we're going to find out more about this union now with Michelle DeRussia, who is author of Katharina and Martin Luther, The Radical Marriage of a Runaway Nun and a Renegade Monk. And it's great to have you here, Michelle. Welcome.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, this is interesting. I have known of the marriage for many years, and I love Luther, and I love reading Luther, but a lot of people don't know about his wife. Why kind of tackle this issue of Luther's marriage in particular?
Well, I think, first of all, Katharina herself made such an enormous contribution to Christian history, and yet we know so little about her. So I certainly wanted to tell her story, and I think understanding their marriage and Luther's role as a father and as a husband can really sort of help us form a more complete picture as to who he was as a theologian and as a reformer and even just simply as a person.
Yeah, for sure. Now, go back a little bit because we know a lot about Luther and nailing the 95 Theses and the Diet of Worms and all that. He was an Augustinian monk. He said even after the fact, didn't he, that he didn't want to get married. How long did he hold to that position after the Reformation broke out that he just didn't have any interest in getting married?
Yeah, it was quite a few years, actually. He held firm to that declaration. He was in favor of marriage for sure, and he wrote a lot about marriage because he was very much interested in bringing marriage the respect that he felt that it deserved, because there was sort of, up to that point, what I call a hierarchy of holiness. So the Roman Catholic Church really emphasized the clerical monastic life as being holier than, and maybe more pure even than, say, a married person's life. And Luther disagreed with that. He said, absolutely not. You know, we are all created equally in the image of God. So whether you're married or whether you're a monastic, you are created equally in the image of God. So he felt very strongly about that, but yet he sort of didn't really want to be married personally, I don't think. And what happened was he was largely responsible for Katharina von Bora and a number of her fellow nuns escaping from a convent. They had read some of Luther's writings that were smuggled into this cloistered convent, his writings against celibacy, and they were convicted. And so they fled from the convent. But the problem was a woman during that time of Katharina's standing, because she was of noble birth, she pretty much had to get married. There were really only two choices. She could be a nun or she could get married. And Luther felt responsible for her. All of the other nuns who escaped from the convent that night were married off, except for Katharina. 2 years later, she was still not married. And I think he really did feel initially a responsibility to her.
Wow. Well, then it doesn't sound so much, at least initially, like the great love story. Like he was swept off his feet, she was swept off her feet. How did they finally get together and agree to get married? What was the process like? Do we know?
Yeah, it's actually kind of a funny story. So Luther tried to set Katharina up with a couple of different suitors. One relationship sort of fell through because the man's parents did not want him marrying a former nun. Surprise, surprise. And the second suitor, she refused to marry, which was a very bold move on her part. She just simply did not like him. And so what she essentially did was she said to Luther, well, I will marry you, or I will marry this other person who was a mutual friend. So she essentially proposed to Luther, which is just crazy, unheard of for that time.
Yeah, so when she did that, what was his response?
Well, he basically said yes. You know, like I said, I don't think he wanted to. They certainly were not in love with each other. He married her out of a sense of duty and obligation, and she married him really as a means to survive. She just really needed to be married. But what's interesting about Katerina is that she did not want to be married to just any person. And as time passed and their relationship grew, they did come to love each other, and, you know, respect and trust. And they had a very tender, sweet, loving relationship. But it didn't start out in the sort of romantic Hollywood movie kind of way that we might like.
No, different time for sure. How old were they at the time?
Katerina was 26 and Luther was 42.
Yeah, he was older. That was what I was recalling. So he was middle-aged Luther by that time. But
And even Katerina at age 26 was considered middle-aged because typically people didn't live nearly as long as they do today.
That's true. What was she like? What do we know about her background? She was a nun, we know, but what was she like as a person? What all did you find out in your research?
It was very challenging to paint a complete picture of Katerina because, sadly, none of her letters to Luther were preserved. So we only have 8 of Katerina's letters total, and those were all written to people after he died. So they were sort of having to do with legal and business issues, which is a statement really on how society really did not value women's voices during that time. I mean, her letters were just simply not kept, which you think, wow, that is just, that's unbelievable that we don't have her side of the story. So it was a little tricky to put together her personality based on what other people said and what Luther himself said about her. But we know that she was feisty and rather bold. I mean, she turned down a marriage proposal, so we know that about her.
Right.
She was also an extremely hard worker. I mean, literally would get up at 4 in the morning, work a 17-hour day running Luther's household and his guests. And she was a dynamo, really. I mean, I got tired reading about her, never mind actually living her life, right?
Yeah, no microwaves back then. There was a lot more work to be done.
I mean, can you imagine even doing the laundry?
No, not at all. I would never make it. But yeah, 17-hour days, that's, I mean, we complain about it with all our modern conveniences, but back then that was a totally different story.
Mm-hmm, exactly.
That is wild. And so they ended up getting married, and then I know that they lost a few children along the way. How many children did they end up having?
They had 6 biological children. 2 of those children died, one as an infant and one as a 13-year-old. 2 daughters passed away. They also fostered, it was up to 11 children. So during that time, people died at a young age from the plague, from other illnesses. And so some of Katerina and Martin Luther's family members died. And so they ended up adopting their nieces and nephews and raising them. So they had a full household of children.
Wow. 11 children and 6 of their own. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And that was really a tough thing for them, wasn't it? Losing their daughters. What is Elizabeth and Magdalena were the daughters that they
That's
lost?
That's right. Yeah. It was excruciating, as you can probably imagine. They really deeply grieved the loss of their 2 daughters, and I think especially their 13-year-old daughter, Magdalena, just because she was older. And I really appreciated Luther's candor on the subject of grief. He admitted that the death of his daughter shook him and his faith to the core, and I really appreciated his honesty about that. And really his willingness to admit that his faith, even Luther's faith, wasn't always rock solid, you know, that it wavered and that he had some real difficult conversations with God as they walked through the tragedy of losing their daughters.
Yes. Yeah, and that's the thing. When you can go back and read the works of great theologians and church figures like Luther and say, hey, he was really a human being. it makes a big difference in how you end up assessing that person who may seem very remote in church history. All of a sudden, they become very, very human. Well, we're going to come back with Michelle DeRusha about her book, Katharina and Martin Luther. Stay with us here on Janet Mefford Today. When an abortion-minded woman walks into a preborn center, it is a divine appointment. It's where she encounters the love of Jesus Christ and has the opportunity to meet the beautiful life growing inside of her and find out that every baby's life matters.
I got to hear how strong her heartbeat was. I was like, I felt like she was supposed to be here. And it didn't matter what anybody else told me. And all that mattered was that I was blessed with the ability to carry life inside of my body. And that baby was supposed to be here for something. And that was all that mattered.
80% of women in crisis pregnancies choose life after meeting their babies on ultrasound. Preborn is the largest provider of free ultrasounds in the country. Would you join with Preborn and Janet Mefford today? For $140, you can sponsor 5 ultrasounds and help save 5 babies' lives. All gifts are tax deductible, and 100% of your donation goes towards saving babies' lives. To donate, call 855-402-BABY, 855-402-2229, or there's a banner to click at janetmefford.com. Are you among the millions of Americans who feel uncertain when it comes to your health care? As a Christian, are you looking for health care that doesn't violate your morals and convictions? Well, we're happy to inform you that there is a solution, and that solution is Liberty Health Share. Liberty Health Share is a community of like-minded Christians who work together to pay for their medical costs. It allows you to decide how, when, and where you will access health care so you can make the best choice for you and your family. Starting at $199 a month for a single, up to $529 a month for a family. That's mom, dad, and all the kids. This is how healthcare should be. For more information, call 855-585-4237 or visit lightyourliberty.com. That's lightyourliberty.com, and regain control over your healthcare costs. 855-585-4237 or lightyourliberty.com. Together, we're changing healthcare for good. We are back on Janet Mefford Today. My guest is Michelle DeRusha. Her book is Katharina and Martin Luther, The Radical Marriage of a Runaway Nun and a Renegade Monk. And, you know, returning to the title, Michelle, when you talk about the marriage of these two as being radical, put that in context, because 500 years after the Reformation, all of us would probably say, OK, so what? They got married. What's so radical about that? What was so radical about it?
Well, primarily that he was a monk and she was a cloistered nun, at least formerly. So that was just an abhorrent thought to Roman Catholics at the time, that the clergy and the monastics would then sort of step down from this position of purity and holiness and sort of step into just ordinary, regular life and marry and, you know, engage in the kind of sexuality that regular people engaged in. And they just couldn't fathom it. You know, it's just absolutely unheard of. Luther was not the very first monk to get married, but he was right up there. I mean, there had only been maybe a handful of monastic marriages prior to there. So it was just completely radical in every sense of the word.
Very revolutionary. What kind of pushback did they get?
Oh, my gosh, so much. I mean, the leaders of the Reformation were against it, even Luther's closest friends, because they felt that this was going to distract him from his work. So he got pushback even from Philip Melanchthon, who was his probably his best friend at the time.
Yeah.
And then just generally from the church, I mean, Katerina especially was vilified. I mean, she was just, I can't even repeat some of the language that she was called. You know, it was just offensive. She was considered a witch, and they were both considered heretics. And she was especially just considered very threatening. There was something about a female monastic, a nun, coming out of the convent and marrying one of the important religious men of the time that I think was seen as very threatening to religious authorities at the time.
Right. But, you know, it really gave legs, didn't it, to Luther's theology, because he was advocating for marriage and saying there isn't any biblical prescription that people in the ministry can't get married. This is wrong. And had he not gotten married, wouldn't it probably have been the case that he couldn't have been seen as so authoritative on that matter because he lived what he said?
That's true. Yeah. And I really think that was one of the tipping points for him. I feel that he felt that he had to sort of live out his theology.
Yeah.
So it was one thing for him to write about marriage from a theological standpoint, but it was another thing for him to demonstrate that he was living that out as well.
Right. And he seemed to be, from what I'm recalling, some of the writings that I've read with Luther referencing Katerina von Bora, very affectionate with his wife, like really seemed to adore her and appreciate what she brought to his life. What did you glean from some of his writings about what she gave him in marriage?
They were so sweet with one another. Like you said, he was so tender toward her. And that was one of the things that really surprised me. And I think it's just because, like you said earlier, we sort of put Luther up on a pedestal with some of the big religious leaders in Christian history, and it's hard to think of him as a regular human being.
Right.
They just had a really witty repartee between them. They liked to joke around. They teased one another. His letters are just jokingly affectionate and just really sweet. I was very, very surprised by that, and it sort of delighted me a little bit.
Oh, that's neat. What would you say, you know, referencing what you just said a couple of minutes ago about all their detractors and those who said, oh, no, this is scandalous. You can't get married. You're a monk and she's a nun. What difference do you think his marriage did make to his work? Because he had table talk and he wrote so much and preached so much. Did his marriage help him or did it hurt him? How much can you really figure that out from what you researched?
I definitely think it helped him. I say towards the end of the book that the Protestant Reformation would have definitely happened regardless of whether Martin Luther married or not, but marrying Katerina certainly made him a different reformer. She really had jurisdiction over the household. And by the household, I mean their business transactions or financial transactions. She managed their real estate. They had multiple properties. She helped him with his manuscripts. She was kind of his go-to woman in terms of making sure that his writings got to the printer on time. And he really, really depended on her a lot for just more than just, you know, putting food on the table and sort of the traditional domestic expectations that you might think about when you're thinking of, you know, the role of a wife.
Yeah.
She really stepped above and beyond that.
Yeah. And you consider all the children, where they had 6 biological children and then fostered as many as 11 children. This on top of, you know, rearing all of those children, taking care of the household and then dealing with real estate and helping out with the writings. I mean, she sounds like you said earlier, really a dynamo.
Yeah, she was for sure. And, you know, Luther, too, was a hands-on father in a lot of ways. And that's something else that surprised me and something that we don't hear a lot about. He traveled a lot, and, of course, he was working a lot. But when he was home, the children were very much part of the Luther's daily household, and they were underfoot, you know. In his study, he writes about how he's working on a particular project and one of his kids is crawling around in his diaper, and just sort of was a very real life look at his life as a father and a husband and as a theologian.
Well, yeah. And when you talk about the Luthers really seeing child rearing as holy work, I think this is very significant because obviously he had a lot of catechetical training. You had Luther's catechism and, you know, the emphasis on teaching the Ten Commandments and the Creed and the Lord's Prayer. This was a regular part of their life, wasn't it? That he was spiritually training and biblically training these kids that he had. He didn't just throw them to Katarina and leave the house. He took it very seriously.
Oh, no, for sure. They sat at the around the table each night for supper and in the morning and read through the Bible and, you know, recited the Lord's Prayer. And like you said, he wrote the small catechism with young children in mind. And he wrote that using his own children sort of as the primary example of the audience to whom he was writing. So, again, he lived that out in real life.
Now, how long did they stay married? How long did the union last?
It was, oh my goodness, I should know this, but it was about 21 years.
21 years. And that, what was it like at the end? Who preceded who in death and what kind of toll did that take?
Yeah, That was the hard part of writing the biography because, you know, biography sort of usually ends with a person's death if they have passed on. So the last chapters are about Luther's death. He passed away first, and Katarina followed a few years later. Unfortunately, he was away traveling, and so she was not at his side when he passed away, and so that was Barry. Hard for her. He did have two of his sons who were traveling with him, so they were there. And then Katarina's life got really, really hard after her husband passed away. And she was sort of entrenched in some legal battles and fighting for custody of her children. And, you know, without a husband, like I said earlier, it was very difficult for women. They just did not have the sort of independence that we are accustomed in this day and age.
Right, right. Who was she fighting custody for her own children?
Well, it's really interesting. Luther had so much faith in Katarina that when he wrote his last will and testament, he put her as the guardian of their children, which was unheard of during that time.
Huh.
So all unmarried women were required to have a male guardian. So when your husband died, you were appointed a male guardian, someone who would oversee your finances and your legal issues and, you know, the decisions that you would make for your children. And Luther really turned that on its head and said, no, Katarina has done an outstanding job raising these children, and she should be the guardian. But what he failed to do was get an attorney to sign off on his will and testament.
Oh.
So, yeah, it became a legal battle for Katarina to really even make decisions for her own children.
Goodness. Well, it is a fascinating story. You can read about it in the book, Katarina Ann Martin Luther, The Radical Marriage of a Runaway Nun and a Renegade Monk. Fascinating stuff. Michelle DeRosa joining us. Michelle, it was great to have you here. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you. It was really interesting to talk with you.
You too. Thanks again. God bless you. And thanks for listening to Janet Mefford today. We'll see you at janetmefford.com. Thanks a lot for being with us.